You're listening to The Edie J. Adler Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Shalom, amigos. Welcome to The Edie J. Adler Show. I'm Edie J. Adler. Again, I apologize. I'm doing the show from home today because I'm a little bit under the weather, but I didn't want to miss the show. We have a very special, important guest today. And we also have Lola, my rescue cockatoo. And you're going to hear all kinds of noises. You're going to hear the clock. You might hear my dogs barking. One of the cats is behind the computer trying to figure out what it is that I'm doing. And hi, Lola. So here we are. The reason I didn't want to miss this opportunity to do the show today is, like I said, we have a very important guest. And as usual, this show is open to every opinion. Everybody is welcome. As long as we keep it civil, as long as we don't start calling each other names. Also, I'm a very strong supporter of Israel. So if you don't support Israel, that's okay. But if you hate Israel, then please change the channel. This is not the show for you. You're welcome to not support Israel. Just don't hate Israel and its people. We have the right to exist. And also, I want to remind you, please, the shelters are full. Because I'm doing this from home today, I don't have a dog for you from the shelter. But if you just take a look, you can go on their website or you can go to any shelter in the nation and make somebody very happy. A dog, a cat, a bird, a turtle. I even have fish now, a couple of goldfish. So please, adopt, don't shop. The dog will make you happy, the cat will. And one last thing. If you don't have the means to support an animal, if you are struggling financially or your health isn't that great and you don't have someone to help you, please don't do it. Please don't do it because you'll end up returning them and that's not fair to anybody. Okay, now it's time to start the show. Excuse me, like I said, I have a very important guest, a very special guest, and I'm going to read the introduction because I don't want to miss anything. So, his name is Joaquin Machado. He's a Venezuelan engineer turned biographer whose life took an unexpected turn in 2020 when the government seized his family's business during the pandemic. That almost happened to my family in Mexico. We got out in time. Originally trained in mechanical engineering and project management, Joaquin shifted his focus to writing. He recently completed his first book, congratulations, a biography of the first elected mayor of his municipality in Caracas, Venezuela. He was chosen for his ability to reveal the deeper personal motivation of the subject in the face of the complexities that come with public service within a turbulent political landscape. With a keen understanding of both Venezuelan and American sociopolitical dynamics, Joaquin sees parallels between the challenges facing the U.S. at this time and Venezuela's recent past. Right in time for our elections, please welcome Joaquin Machado. Joaquin, welcome to the Edie J. Adler Show.
Thank you for having me, Edie. The pleasure is mine.
So please, I introduce you. But please tell us a little bit more about yourself. What brings you to the U.S.? What motivated you to write your book? And then I'll be asking some other questions.
Well, okay, let's answer that in that order. I'm in the U.S. for personal reasons. I'm visiting a relative and doing a little sightseeing. I've been coming to the U.S. ever since I was a little boy. I think my first visit was when I was 2 or 3 years old. And I used to come here every summer for medical checkups for my eyesight. I hadn't come in a very long time. In fact, I hadn't been here since the pandemic, since 2019, since before the pandemic. The pandemic.
Yeah.
Well, one of the reasons I didn't come here is because I didn't get vaccinated, and I didn't want to get vaccinated, and it was a little, like, I didn't get the Moderna or the any of the American vaccine. So it was a little difficult to be able to come here if I didn't have that. And then, well, after those restrictions were lifted and everything and other alternatives arose, then I was able to visit again. I think the longest I've been without coming here was those 5 years. And precisely during that time, In 2020, our family business was seized by the government with no compensation. And for a while there, I was sitting on my hands for a little bit, and a friend of the family came upon the opportunity to make this biographical work, and he approached me. And it was a very challenging. It was an enterprise because there was really very little to no written down information. So we had to get lots of testimonies from different people, and it was from a long time ago that the lady was mayor in 1980, from 1989 to 1992. So many of those people aren't around anymore, unfortunately. And we started working on that, and we just recently finished it. And now it's in the book is being edited and getting ready for publication.
Is it in Spanish only, or is it in English?
It's going to be in Spanish. It's probably going to have it's going to be released in Venezuela because it's a very, very local, Venezuelan thing. It's about a mayor, the first mayor in Venezuela. But we'll see how it does, and then if we can negotiate a wider distribution, then we could probably bring it to the U.S. eventually.
I hope so. What kind of business did your family have?
Well, we had a moderately sized gas station and store. It was a small business. It wasn't really a big business. It was enough to live on, and for at least before before 1998, it was enough to live on. And then after the political turmoil that Venezuela went through, and the destruction of the standard of living, it became a little bit more unsustainable. Until finally, they took it from us.
Under what pretense?
Well, the thing is, during 2020, there was in 2019, the U.S. imposed sanctions on Venezuela, and that caused lots of problems in the internal market. Now, even the government will probably say it was just because of the sanctions. But the truth is, our internal industry, our internal petroleum industry, was a little bit in disarray as well, and so we didn't have any gas, or we had very little gas, and so it was deemed that it as a strategic resource of the nation, and under that pretext, they seized not all, but quite a few gas stations during that time. Ours was included, along with everything that was built around it, of course.
You know, I've never been to Venezuela, but I remember growing up seeing programming from Venezuela, funny shows, soap operas, all kinds of things, and pictures of Venezuela. It looked like an awesome country. It looked beautiful. The people are beautiful. The women are gorgeous. And it looked like everybody was doing well. What happened?
Well, everybody's going to give it a different name, but essentially, I think the problem was that we had a revolution, an ideologically possessed revolution. It was possessed by an offshoot of Marxist thought, and the main figure leading that effort was a caudillo-like figure named Hugo Chavez. And in 1998, he was democratically elected to take over the government. And the first thing he did was erase the constitution, create a new constitution, change the powers of government, eliminate the Senate. He changed the entire political structure of the country in order to guarantee the success of his revolution. And then he called his form of government 21st century socialism. And it was touted by many of the, international socialists, the internationalist socialist movement. Many prominent figures came in defense of the system, saying that it could possibly work, and this time it's going to work. And it turns out that what he did was he used a lot of the oil revenue, of the oil windfalls, to fund a gigantic smorgasbord of social programs that, in their time, they did help many people, but as it turns out, they were unsustainable. And eventually the chickens came home to roost. The Venezuelan economy couldn't sustain it. The price of oil went down. International reserves plummeted. And that led the country into a spiral, into an economic spiral of hyperinflation. Because of the hyperinflation, the government decided that the only way to deal with it, instead of incentivizing production, was to decree minimum wage hikes. At a rate of one or two or maybe even three per year. I think it was two per year. Sometimes these hikes were 30%, 50% increases. And that fed into the hyperinflation. And in the end, if you had the cumulative effect of all of that is that if you had taken $8 trillion, and that's $8 million, and you had deposited them in the bank in 1998, you would have a single dollar today. That's the cumulative effect of the inflation.
People don't understand that socialism has never worked and it never will. I don't understand why people continue to have this fantasy that the government can take care of you and you're going to live happily ever after. I don't get it. Are people in Venezuela happy now? The majority?
Well, funny you should use that word. In 2012, right before one of the most massive economic crashes that we had, which came in around 2014. In 2012, there was one of these polls that people do around the world where the happiest country in the world. And they would... supposedly Venezuela won. It was what they do is they ask people, how happy do you feel? And it's a self-report poll. And Venezuela occupied either the first or the second place or something like that. It was decreed the happiest country on earth. And so people were happy then because, the government was spending a lot of money. It was helping a bunch of people that maybe, perhaps would not have otherwise been able to receive that help, that amount of help that easily. And so people were happy, but then, you can't do that. It's unsustainable. It's unsustainable. You're much better off teaching people to fish rather than giving them fish. And so people are not that happy anymore. In fact, there was an election on the 28th of July, I think it was, this year. And as far as I can tell, that election, the government lost that election with a margin of 70 to 30%. People aren't happy. And I don't think that if you will go and poll people in the street, I don't think they'll say they're very happy anymore. You see a lot of long and dejected faces. Things have gotten more difficult.
It's a shame. For sure. The problem with the socialist government is that once they get into power, it's practically impossible. My bird is eating my chair. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
It's practically impossible to get the
to displace back, it. Yeah.
To get the country back, because they know how to cheat, and they will cheat forever. You know, yesterday my husband and I went to vote. I have my little I voted thing. Mm-hmm. And I keep telling people to please vote with their brain, not with their emotions. I voted for Donald Trump. I don't like any. I don't like everything he says, but I don't vote for his opinions. I vote for his actions. When he was our president, the economy was great. There were no wars in Ukraine or the Middle East. We were producing our own oil. Iran was under control. And now everything is going down the drain. Do you see any parallels between what's happening here and what's happened in Venezuela?
Quite a few. Well, one of the first parallels that I see is a little, there's a video snippet going around in the internet from around 2019 or 2020. It was a Maduro speech, and in that speech he used the word fascist 17 or 18 different times, directed at 18 different people. And there may be some people whose idea of government is akin to fascism, but I don't see that as an extant political movement anymore. And so when I hear people screaming fascist, 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 it immediately makes me think of the revolution back home. That kind of name calling and the fear mongering about fascism is very typical. And I see that being used a lot here, and that gives me pause. And there are things about the Democratic, like, I can't be unfair. There are things about the Democratic Party that I like. And there were figures in the Democratic Party that I liked, but most of them have joined up with Trump. People like Tulsi Gabbard and Robert Kennedy Jr. And so the fact that there's this coalition forming around him is probably a pretty good sign that he isn't a fascist, as they say. And another one of the parallels that I see are in the policy objectives that the proposed Harris administration has put forth. This talk about price gouging.
Mm-hmm.
That's the term in English. Yeah. So when we were facing the hyperinflationary crisis in Venezuela, the speech was constantly about price gouging, and the government's idea to solve that was to increase the minimum wage, like artificial wage hikes, and they used consumer protection agencies to heavily regulate large, medium, and even small businesses all over the country in a very, very, very punitive regulatory environment. So they came down hard on the business owners. And there was a lot of talk about the business owners hoarding, merchandise and price gouging. That was the government's idea of the origin of hyperinflation. But, we know that hyperinflation is a monetary phenomenon. It comes from government overspending and then having to make up for that by producing, inorganic currency, just increasing the money supply. And so they wouldn't cop to the fact that they had increased the money supply and created the inflation themselves. They would chase after the business owners. And I see the margins that food retail chains here in the United States use, they have tiny margins, something like 2%. The margins are even smaller than the ones that we had in Venezuela. And there, and there's talk about price gouging. That is not, that is not a good thing that I see there. What other parallels? Well, there's a tendency that I see in the modern Democratic Party to divide people by race and by origin and by religion and by sexual orientation that I also perceived back at the beginning stages of the revolution back in my country. There was a marked desire to create racial consciousness. They did it through things like the census. They started adding racial categories to the census that didn't exist, and they started changing the names of streets and places, and they started changing the symbols of the cities and of the municipalities, and you know, like the crests and stuff, mm-hmm. and the names of famous places and famous streets, and even the giant mountain that's right behind our city, they changed that, the name of that. And so they changed it from this, because Venezuela was at some point it was a Spanish colony, and they changed from the Spanish name to the names that the Native Americans used before the Spanish came. And so there was a very, very strong attempt to create that sort of consciousness in the Venezuelan people. And that would have otherwise, in my opinion, created a very strong division between people. But Venezuelans are very gregarious, and that didn't have the same effect that I think it's having here. Whereas here I see a lot more.
It's all happening here. You know,
it's having a great.
They have separate graduations mm-hmm. for white people, black people, Latinos. Yeah. Why would anybody who thinks clearly want that? I am Mexican, but I'm also a citizen of the United States, and I'm a Jewish person. And I don't want to be just one thing. I don't want to be just Mexican. I don't want to be just Jewish. I don't want my religion to define me. I'm proud to be Jewish, and I will always support Israel, and I will fight for Israel when necessary, and I will stand for Israel until God allows me to, with my last breath. But I don't want to have a separate graduation. I don't want to have a separate store to go to. I don't want to have separate parties. I don't even like the name Hispanic. I actually despise the name Hispanic, because as you probably know, Hispanic literally means from Spain.
Correct.
Well, my ancestors went to Mexico from Lithuania. So technically, I'm not Hispanic. I'm not from Spain.
That's correct.
It's Mexican, yes. Latina, yes, because I speak a language derived from Latin. But I'm not Hispanic, and people proudly call themselves Hispanic without even knowing what it means. And they want to separate themselves, and that's just not a good thing to do.
No.
That's what it says. It says that, I don't remember who said it, but it was some historic figure who said, divide and conquer.
Julius Caesar.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Divide and conquer. And that's what they're doing. That's what they did to your beautiful country. And that's what they're doing to my beautiful country now. And it's happening in Mexico, too. Mexico, I'm not surprised. My father decided to leave a very successful business in Mexico because he saw it coming. And he's in heaven now. But if he saw what was happening here, his heart would be broken. I hope people wake up. I hope people vote with their brains and not their emotions, and they don't drink Kool-Aid, as they say. And I'm glad that you came on the show today, because your experience is something that we're trying to avoid here.
I hope so. I mean, the one thing that I've always admired about the American project, about the American story and the American ethos, is the coming together of different peoples to create a single united nation. And it happens fractally, like from the smallest level to the largest level. So people come together and they form a community, and those communities come together and they form a city. And so every city in the United States has like its own identity and their own traditions and festivals. Then they come together into a single state, which is itself an autonomous political unit that then comes together with other states to create the greater union. And so it's that coming together at every level. And I've always admired the way in which the United States makes every upper echelon of those levels respect the lower ones, but they still maintain that unity. And it would be a shame, and I hope it doesn't happen, and people have to fight in order to maintain that American spirit of coming together, even despite, you know, our differences and you know, in religion or origin or ethnicity. I myself, I'm not American, but if I had been given the choice, I would have been.
Yeah. And I don't see anybody trying to build a fence to keep people out. So that has to say something about this country, that everybody wants to come here. It's good. You can come here with nothing and work yourself to a multimillionaire. Not everybody does that, but you have the opportunities if you have the hard work and the desire and the brains to do that. You can't do that in a country like Mexico. You can't do that in Venezuela now, but you can do it here still. And we're hoping that we preserve that.
In those countries, the only way to make something of yourself, like these type of government systems that can be subsumed under the moniker of socialism, what these systems do is they collapse everything into a single game, which is the political game. And so if you want to make something of yourself, the only game you can play is the political game. That's it. There's no more. Because if you try to play, you know, the transportation game or the, I don't know, the live streaming interview game or the entertainment game or the academic production game, whatever other games you try to play, there's always going to be a point at which somebody's going to approach you and say, you can't do this unless you pledge your allegiance to this or that, or unless you become political, and that's when you can get access to resources. Because the market it doesn't have the power to sustain you, because the market is depleted. The only thing that's flush are the government, as the only one entity with a capacity, with a spending capacity, is usually affiliated to the government or the government itself. And so you have to play the political game in whatever area of you're going to, whatever economic activity that you're going to do, you have to immerse yourself in the political game as well.
Don't you have to also be connected and know someone or be related to someone?
Typically it's very difficult to I mean, it's not impossible to start businesses and to get financing from outside sources, but you do have to be connected. If somebody suddenly says, you know, takes a liking to your business or your brand or your factory, and they decide to seize it, if you're not connected, you have no protection from that. And so people don't go into business unless they have some sort of connection with the government, typically. Whereas in freer countries, that's not the case. In freer countries, everyone has the opportunity to rise up, and that creates a lot more opportunities for everyone because it creates a lot more businesses. The model, the socialist model, is nobody does anything, and everybody receives from the government just a tiny little bit. And that tiny little bit right now, I think pensions, the pension is like something around $3 a month or $4 a month.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's not a living, not really, not in terms of buying power. Of course, in our currency, it looks like a lot of money. Right now, it's like 120 or 150, I think, bolivares, but that's not a lot, really, in terms of the buying power. The buying power is $4, $3 or $4. She can buy doing odd jobs, working outside. There's a lot of most of the economy, or a large part of the economy, is sub rosa, which is under the table. It doesn't just people just do informal economic activity. And or they have their pension, they do other they have like another job. I mean, there are people who are, you know, the people who are most affected by inflation and hyperinflation are salaried workers and pensioners. And I've seen some of those people who basically they're near starvation. At least they were a couple years ago. Things are a little bit better after the pandemic, because during the pandemic, there was a de facto dollarization of the economy. And so people started trading in dollars, and that alleviated things a little bit. But before that, there was a very strong, very stringent currency exchange control, and people didn't have access to dollars, and there was nothing to do, and there was very little in the way of food, and the supermarket shelves were very kind of empty, and people didn't have access to real money. The joke was that at that time, there are pictures from that time where people are using, you know, the bills, the our currency's bills, and they're making like little belts and purses and animal sculptures with the money, because the paper itself is probably worth more than the denomination printed on it.
Wow. Something that people don't understand is that when you increase the minimum wage, it hurts everybody. It hurts businesses. It hurts production. It hurts. I would rather negotiate my own salary and get paid according to my abilities and my work. But if you set, let's say, a $20 minimum wage, then what businesses have to do, they have to increase their prices, or they have to fire people, and they're going to go to automation.
And
lose their job.
Exactly. It's counterintuitive, because when you're a minimum wage worker and you're faced with a situation where you have to go up to your boss and everybody else is earning the same and you want to earn a little more, and you have to negotiate that, right? And so when the government says, no, I'll do the negotiation for you, I'll just make an increase and that'll be that. The minimum wage worker feels a relief and says, oh my God, well, thank you for doing that for me. But there's a cumulative effect to that. So let's say you're working, I don't know, at a beauty a spa, and you do somebody's nails, and now that person has to pay more for their nails. But since the people at the supermarket are also paying a higher minimum wage, when you go and you buy food, or when you go to, you know, service your car or everything, you're also paying more. And so the effect that nominal increase, that increase in name only, has on your wage seems like it's making it bigger, but in the long run, it's probably having a either no effect or a net negative effect in the case, in our case, which, you know, our minimum wage hikes just kept increasing. They kept feeding into the hyperinflation crisis, and the value of our money just was destroyed. I remember there was a time where I calculated what the typical Venezuelan minimum wage was at some point. It had 30 times less buying power than the other countries in the region. And that was relatively, it wasn't as low as it is now. But now most people don't earn minimum wage. I don't think anyone would work for the actual minimum wage anymore. It's ridiculous. It doesn't get you anything. You can't afford a carton of eggs a month with that.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's so sad. It really makes me sad.
Some people
have the resources. Venezuela has the resources to be a country.
And yes, it does.
It there's only a little bit of people who are rich.
Yes, it does. But the thing is, you cannot make, there's no law that you can pass that can make people prosperous. Everybody has to, you know, put in sweat equity in order to make a country prosperous. But you can sign away prosperity with a single decree. And because you can stop people from, you can create distortions that will stop people or disincentivize people from working or from investing. Or from feeling safe and secure in their person and their possessions in your country. And so the people who have the possibility, they flee, and the people who are left over, they have no opportunities to do anything because there are no jobs, there's no energy in the economy and there's nowhere to go. And so a lot of people sit on their hands and then the government comes in and says, "Oh, give you a basket of food every month or every week," and you have to make do with whatever you get from them. And most of the time, it's not very high quality. And that's what happens in socialist countries. It's what happened in Venezuela with many people. Many people, they only get the food they get is what they get from government programs. And sometimes you get rice, and sometimes you get rice with weevils, and sometimes you get Chinese products, and you don't know really if they are what they claim to be, or if they are watered down with weird chemicals. So, because really, nobody controls that. There's no supervision.
What about the medical system?
Well, the public medical system in Venezuela is ruined as well. There are some public hospitals that still work, but these are at the level of municipality mostly. These attention centers work because of city governments, typically, and sometimes state governments too, but there's no national. The ones that are in charge of you know, purportedly national entities, national socialist entities, not national socialist as a Nazi, but national level socialist entities, people have to bring their own gauze, people have to bring their own injections, people have to bring their own stuff in order to get treated. And sometimes the machines are in disarray and disuse, and they haven't been maintained. Because one of the things about the socialist ethos is that they think that capitalists charge, a capitalist will charge what the market will bear. That's true in that sense. But they think that everything that the capitalist charges is just, it goes into the pockets of the big cats, and they have no notion of maintenance. And right now Cuba is having that problem with their electricity. Their grid is gone because they didn't maintain it, and so they don't do maintenance to the machines and the public health system. They don't do maintenance to the equipment for the electrical distribution system, and these things over time they decay. Even just really, like, it's not really that complicated. You have vegetation growing around the power lines. That will create a giant hazard because it's dry vegetation, a dry climate, and anything that triggers a fire will take out those power lines and they'll leave a section of the country or a section of the main city in that particular state without electricity for days, just because they don't have, you know, the what do you call it, the groups of people to go there and do and cut the vegetation around the power lines. So it's not even at a very highly sophisticated level of taking apart the machines and cleaning them from the inside, which is something that also has to be done, and you have to replace the consumables as well. They don't do much of that, and so they think that everything that you charge is pocketable. It's part of the I don't know, the mindset and
greenwash.
Yeah, it's part of yeah. And so when they're in charge, they do very little maintenance, and then they deal with things as they arise. So it's crisis after crisis after crisis. It's it's always the present. They never plan for the future, and they never remember the past. And when they do, they change it at their convenience in order to make people, you know, believe things happened that didn't. That's right. George Orwell has quite a few books on that subject.
Yeah. So as an outsider, how do you see this country? Where do you think we're going? Looking at it from the side.
If I told you that I knew what was going to happen, it would be a lie. I don't know what's going to happen. I can tell you that what could happen, okay?
Excuse me.
If polarization keeps increasing, like if Americans continue to play the game of polarization, you're going to have a very divided country, and both parties are going to become kidnapped, as it were, by the most radical elements in each of the parties. I see that right now. I see that as most likely in the Democrat Party, but it could possibly happen in the Republican Party as well. There's a path to that. And so one of my main it's a double-sided challenge, because you want to avoid anything that sounds like socialism from one of the parties. But at the same time, you want to bridge the gap and avoid the polarization, like stop with the name calling and the alarmism and all that. There are some people that I've heard make a case. There are some moderate voices, like, for example, Megyn Kelly. She's made the case that, yes, she doesn't agree with the Democrats, but she's not going to start saying that the country will be over if Kamala Harris is elected president. That's probably a good attitude to have, even though there is a risk, and a very high risk, that she will implement policies that will take the country down a very dark road. We want to be able to say that without creating the kind of enmity that they are, and fear that they are generating on the other side, that has led to 3 assassination attempts of the opposition candidate in the United States, which is a phrase I never thought I would ever utter in my life. And so you maintain calm. I think it's possible, especially for people who have the wherewithal to go through, you know, difficult situations in life. And so you have to maintain the kind of calm, saying, okay, this is happening, it's bad, but we're not going to descend to panic. And we're going to try to extend a moderately cautious amount of, extend a cautious amount of grace to the people on the other side, especially not necessarily the leadership, but especially the people. There are good people who support both parties, and there are people who are not as informed, or people who don't know what the agenda of the Democratic Party is, or people who still believe in many of the legacy mainstream media's stories, and they're probably good. They're nice people, but they're not necessarily evil people. But they still believe in all that. So you have to. There has to be a sort of
balance,
calm. You don't want to descend into name calling and be angry at the dinner table at the Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving is coming up, and people start yelling at each other. Let's not do that anymore. Let's just have the kind of, I'm looking for the word, but I can't remember it. You have to have a paucity of spirit that comes with knowing that you have the right of it, and so you don't need to lose your cool. Okay, keep your cool. You're right. Head up, shoulders back, and maintain a cool and calm demeanor. People don't necessarily, not everybody's going to see it your way, but if you people read more into the way you comport yourself than in any argument that you're going to be able to make at any given time, even if it's the best of arguments.
Right.
They see you, right? So just be cool, and be good to people, and stay firm in your convictions. And I think that if people can remain friendly and they can remain civil and they can avoid the sort of policies that have failed all across the world, then things should be okay. This country is very resilient, and it has gone through a lot worse than it is going through right now.
Very well put. Well, we're coming to the end of the show. I want to thank you for joining us. And the door is always open for you whenever you're in the United States or even from Venezuela. We might do another
show. Thank you.
Thank you for your courtesy and your insight. Good luck with the book. And let me know when it's published and where it's available so we can publicize it and recommend it to people.
Okay, absolutely. That's perfect. And well, if people want to follow me on social media, I'm on X at Tweets Joaquin. I still have the holdover name from the old times.
Yes.
When it was Twitter. I have to change that, but I haven't done that because I haven't had as strong a social media presence I'm relatively new to speaking out about these things, and so I haven't chased any sort of
You're very
fame or influence.
You're very eloquent. So give that information again. Where can people find you?
They can find me on X at Tweets Joaquin.
Spell your name, please, because some people here spell it with an X.
Okay, so it's going to be at TWEETSJOAQUIN. That's JOAQUIN. Like Joaquin Phoenix.
Very nice. Thank you, Joaquin. Good luck with the book. Have a safe return home when you do.
Thank you, Edie. Thank you, Edie. Thank you for having me. This was a great opportunity. Thank you very much. I enjoyed it a lot.
You're very eloquent, and I thank you for your insight.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Stay in touch, please.
Will do. Absolutely.
Well, my friends, we're coming to the end of the show. Thank you for tuning in to the EDJ Adler Show. And remember to always, always be grateful. Until next time.
You're listening to The EDJ Adler Show, only on LA Talk Radio.